Welcome to the FinHub, a Canadian Founders Podcast, where we do a deep dive with founders of today's leading fintechs. My name is Priscilla Silva, and I am your co-host and a second-year MBA student at Rotman School of Management. In this episode, I had the pleasure to talk to Hanif Joshahani. Hanif is a Rotman alumni and co-founder and CEO of Cement. His background includes 15 years of senior roles in capital markets, energy finance, business development, and of course, entrepreneurship in a broad range of industries, including investment banking, energy, and technology. He has raised over $150 million across the four companies he has founded, with several exits to date. In this episode, we talk about entrepreneurship, the importance of how to communicate with your clients, his thoughts on how to have a successful career, and much, much more. So I hope you enjoyed the show. Hi, Hanif. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How does it feel to be one of our first guests?
I'm pretty happy about it. I guess I'm honored. Obviously, Rotman played a big role into my... Before Rotman, I was working in the U.S. So the friends that I made at Rotman and the career path that I started at Rotman has kind of led to where I am today. So I'm glad to give back any way I can.
Amazing. Well, thanks for joining me today. Hanif, your personal story is fascinating, and I thought we could maybe start off and give the audience the opportunity to hear it too. So it would be great if you could share a little bit of your background and your journey pre-Cement.
Yeah, so just really quickly, I did my undergraduate degree in the U.S. in economics and math, and then I worked in hedge funds, I worked in trading firms, investment banks, mostly on the derivative side, and then eventually really wanted to come back to Canada knew that I didn't want to be in trading and derivatives forever, knew that I wanted to be in business in some way, didn't feel like a economics degree and a math degree were going to really get it done. I wasn't well-rounded enough, and so knew an MBA felt like the natural way to kind of get back into Canada, and so I did a MBA at Rotman, started my career in investment banking, doing M&A, strategic review, things like that on Bay Street. And that kind of led to my corporate career in corporate finance. And then eventually started my first company 13 years ago now. You know, this is my fourth company now that I've started in 13 years, Cement. And along the way, I've also set up a family office, and we've made, not just in tech, predominantly in tech, but across technology, movies, real estate, clean energy, and then obviously public market stuff. We've made a bunch of investments. And so we built up a portfolio of over like 40, 50 startups alone in the family office. And so there's a team that manages that. So, it's really exciting. This is all I know how to do now. I like to think that I'm a constant student of the game of entrepreneurship. And the only thing that's the most exciting thing in my life other than my family is Cement. The third most exciting thing after my family and Cement is investing and supporting all of these other entrepreneurs that are building companies and transforming the business landscape in Canada and the U.S. So that's... You know, I work at Cement, and in my spare time, I do other startup work with other startups. I mean, the startups in my family, that's all I got time for these days.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so interesting that you have, you know, this entrepreneur blood in your veins. And by the way, congratulations on being selected EY Entrepreneur of the Year Prize winner.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It was a cool recognition. I view that more as a Cement recognition than an individual recognition, to be honest with you. It takes a village in that case. I think I kind of wish as they gave us the trophy, I was like, you know, this should say the award goes to Cement rather than to Hanif or anything like that. It really was a team effort.
And even before founding Cement, as you mentioned, you already sold several businesses along the way, have been investing in firms across different industries. I wanted to ask you, when did you realize that you had this passion for entrepreneurship?
Since I was a kid, you know, there's just so many weird examples. Since I was a small child, you know, my dad was a heavy duty mechanic. We didn't have a lot of money. And so he was trying to, one of our early jobs, he was a well-educated man, but when we came to, like, he came to North America, the best job he could get was at a mechanic shop for used cars. And, we finally started saving enough money, and he would buy one used car at a time, fix it up on the side in addition to his job, and try to sell it in front of our house. He, you know, when he was selling like smaller, like Nissan Sentras and stuff like that, we did okay. And then we saved up enough money, and he was like, I'm going to do something big now. You know, he had a lot of dreams as well. And we bought this Mercedes. He fixed it up, put it in front of the house. He couldn't sell it. And then one day he wasn't feeling well. He had an upset stomach. He went upstairs, you know, to get some water and to go to the bathroom. And he's like, can you go talk to them? And I went outside, and it was this family that was looking at buying the car. And before he came back out of the house, I'd sold the car. And I was like, how old was I? 15 years old. And, you know, and at school, I used to, you know, buy wholesale sunglasses and sell them to the other kids. And I used to work at a sandwich place. And when my bosses closed down the restaurant, I used to kind of run a card game there. And when I was at university, I started an online bookstore to compete with Barnes and Nobles, where we wrote like an e-commerce site, and we would store the used textbooks so that people wouldn't have to pay such a big premium for textbooks year after year. And we built a library of curriculum and attached it. Like, it was always something in it, you know, I went into business with my cousins while I was in university. We bought, like, he bought light and smoke equipment, and we would do independent, like, hosting parties and stuff like that. All the equipment for the DJs and the lights, everything in my life is there was always an angle, you know, there was always mm-hmm. like, you know, you go to the restaurant, you sit down, and as people are coming and going in and out of the restaurant, instead of enjoying the meal, I would sit down with my cousin or my dad. And the first thing we would go is like, how many people are coming and going? What's the margins? What is it because of the location of the food? And we would do a full analysis on the profitability of the business as soon as we sit down. Like, it was just we couldn't let it go. Like, it's just something that was like bred into me all my life. And so that's kind of why when I left investment banking and I went into business, I was like, I felt like I was at home, you know, like this is what I was meant to do. So it made a lot of sense.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Thanks for sharing. I wanted to know a little bit more about the background story of Cement, because I think that Cement has a very unique value proposition to help clients through difficult times. I wanted to know, when was the moment that you thought, well, this is what we are doing, this is why we are doing it, and this is how we're going to do it?
It's evolved a lot. So I will admit that as first and foremost, the initial vision of the company, core elements of that initial vision are still in existence today and are still part of the foundations of what makes us who we are. But obviously, as we've learned and evolved, our vision for the art of the possible has evolved with it. I was actually just on a call with one of these entrepreneurs where I'm an investor in his company. And he was asking me, he's like, did you ever vision Cement would become this big company? And I was like, no. When the beginning, I had a great vision for the problem that I wanted to solve to make a social impact. But I hadn't really put as much thought into the vision of how big it could become and how many people it could touch and positively impact. Could we become a global company? I didn't have that vision, but it evolved. And I do have that vision now. But at its core, it was a desire to make a social impact. So when I grew up, you know, we grew up really, really poor. And before my dad and my mom got to, you know, I got out of the Middle East before my parents did. And I was here, we were put up with foster families and stuff like that. And collections was always like this thing that really, really had a negative impact on my early childhood. And I always carried that with me. Like, you know, like it's just done so poorly and it has such a negative impact on people. And I'd experienced that firsthand. And so the original story of cement was me wanting to build something that solves a problem that I'd experienced with the mindset of, I want to give back and I want to kind of be the major point of my career to be something that I've done to positively influence the world that I've benefited so much from. And so my idea was simple. It was like, hey, if we can do a better job engaging with customers and show more empathy, leverage technology to productize science so that communication could be more empathetic. That was it. That was the initial idea, was instead of carpet bombing people and harassing them and making, basically making them submit, like this mindset of I'll harass you so much so I overwhelm you, which is predominantly the way not just collections is done, marketing and all these other things. It feels like sometimes it's this like blunt force attempt to just overwhelm people with messages. And it's becoming less, and it started losing its effectiveness some 5-10 years ago, and it's become less and less effective over time. And so the thesis was simple. If we can leverage technology to productize science, then we can target people behaviorally a lot better. And if we do that, then we can get the right message at the right time with the right kind of behavioral tone and response. And if people pay attention to you with the right mindset, better outcomes happen. Relationships are preserved between companies and people. People solve their problems. And overall, you just have a positive win-win impact across the ecosystem. So that's kind of where it started. It was a very lofty, high-level vision. And I don't think we really had an understanding of how hard it would be to do that at scale. I guess naively, we thought, yeah, we can do this for sure. And it's been a great journey. We've had a lot of traction. We have some great customers. And now we've, you know, spent a ton of money over the last year, year and a half, now investing into upgrading and up-leveling the platform so that we can have a technology advantage and be the clear category leader in behavioral-based customer engagement for the next 5 to 10 years.
Could you talk a little bit more about behavior data? What is it exactly?
It's the concept of basically analyzing everything you know about a customer to then be very intentional about the behavioral tactics that you deploy in communicating with that customer. So the behavioral tactics could be everything from the channel you select, the time of day that you select, based on what they respond back, the way that you follow up, the tone of voice that you use, the offer that you give them, how you communicate and describe that offer. So every little thing about how you target and the cadence, channel, and content of communication at the end of the day could have behavioral design influence it. So those are that's a large array of variables across a huge multi-millions of people in a population. And then so then the optimization exercise that our technology looks to solve is, who do I target using what things at what time? And that's basically what our platform does, is not only does it allow you to kind of target people better from a behavioral science standpoint, but based on how they respond and the analysis of how they respond, it can iterate and optimize very quickly and learn so that it gets better and better over time, which is super important in a world where things are changing very, very quickly.
And talking about cement growth, I think that cement scale up pretty quickly. And looking back, what would you say that are the key inflection points, or, you know, the key decisions that you believe have laid the foundation of what cement is today?
Great question. So the key inflection points, I think I'd start with the first customer, honestly. So our first couple of customers, all they told us was, we'd be willing to, if you guys give us a free trial, willing to try this on a small subset of our customers because we believe in the vision that you believe in. So even though you're not a big mature company, we're willing to go on this journey with you. That was, I think, the single biggest inflection point. And so a lot of credit goes to those early organizations, such as Shaw and Telus, where they just took a chance on us, you know, and we took that opportunity and we gave it everything we had and we delivered a lot of value and it built up over time. So I think that was the one of the biggest early inflection points. The other early, you know, the first round of financing into Cement I led, you know, and that was enough to kind of build the initial prototype and validate a bunch of do a bunch of research and build an early initial team and things like that. But once we had a couple of these opportunities to kind of deploy for larger companies, we needed to really ramp up the capabilities of the company in security and platform capability, everything, right? And so we needed to raise money. And so I'd say the other big inflection point was our first investor, because we didn't have revenue. We were pre-revenue. All we had was a couple of agreements for free trials with big companies. And so somebody really had to kind of take a big leap of faith in investing in us. And a lot of that credit goes to, again, our early investors, institutional investors. The one that really comes to mind is Impression Ventures, which is a fintech VC in Toronto. They took a big leap of faith in us as well. The next really big point of inflection, I think, for us, there's been a lot of them, but is what's coming now. So we raised a ton of money last year, you know, end of 2020 and early 2021. We raised a ton of money with the idea that now that we have the pattern, we're going to build the platform and make a massive investment into platform capability. So our R&D spend is double our peers. Like, we spend a huge amount of money on technology and a fraction of everyone else's money on sales and marketing. So we've been investing massively, you know, into the platform capabilities. And so, you know, there's an old proverb that, you know, grow smart, grow thoughtfully until you nail the product. And then once you really nail the product and it can scale and it's better than everyone else's, you know, the efficiencies of that awesome product will be felt everywhere in the way that you work. And so then once you've nailed the product, you have another big decision to make, which is now don't grow thoughtfully, don't grow carefully, grow so fast you scare everyone and you win the market. And so I think starting 2022, we're going to enter this next phase, which is now that we've nailed the product and we have a clear technology advantage, we want to be very, very aggressive in terms of global growth. And I think so the next point of inflection is actually coming up for Cement in 2022.
So I wanted to talk about global growth. What is next?
Everything. So selling through channel partners, selling into Latin America, selling into Europe, selling into Asia, extending. So now we've been able to abstract away from just collections. So we're just a better customer engagement platform across any kind of care or collections or retention, loyalty, any kind of user case, really, where you're feeding a single optimization engine. So the more user cases you run, the better all the targeting of and the insights across all the user cases get, right? So what we are going to be starting next year is a no-code behavioral AI-powered customer engagement platform for large enterprise business users, where a lot of complexity is designed in a way that it can be easily used by a business user in an agile way. So with that platform now in hand, we have to kind of really focus on our go-to-market and, you know, massive expansion into the United States. We're already in the United States. We're going to expand faster there. We're going to expand into more user cases across our current customers, and we're going to grow into new markets. So we've signed some deals so that we can start to expand with partners into other markets like Europe and Latin America. So those are going to be the next key areas of focus.
Amazing. And regarding that topic about strategy, expansion, Could you please share the criteria that you considered when thinking about expanding your products or the verticals or to other regions? How is that for you?
So we have a prioritization matrix that we use against these things. It's a combination of, do we view that our product will be a leading product, top two product for solving the whatever that problem or user case is? What is the competitive landscape in that market? What is the size of the market? What are the entry barriers? So the regulatory, the cost of operations, things like that. So the combination of those things, we use to then evaluate, okay, which one should we do first? Because eventually you want to be like a global business that's pervasive everywhere, but you can't get there all at once. You need to, in a world of scarce, finite resources, you know, even the most aggressive company can only grow at a certain pace while spending its capital wisely and not being wasteful. And creating shareholder value, right? And so we really try to focus in places where we feel like our product is going to have a large impact from a value proposition, product market fit perspective. We have a clear advantage against the user case, and we're entering a market with a large addressable market where we feel that we're going to be well positioned to capture a good chunk of that addressable market.
Mm-hmm. And I can think about any other product more important right now, given the impact of COVID in the overall economy. And on that note, did you notice any change in customer engagement and repayment patterns in the last, 1-2 years?
Tons. Everybody likes to combine COVID into this one single event. From a consumer perspective, it was multiple events, in my opinion. So you had that initial window, right? So everything from February, March, all the way to the end of the summer, or even the end of the year. And that was like the, what I call, we were washing our groceries phase, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was the phase where nobody really knew what was going up, and the market actually had a seizure and everything stopped, and governments pumped a ton of dough into the ecosystem, and people were doing debt forgiveness and interest freezes, and consumers were calling up and call centers were shut down and everything else. So in that environment, consumers weren't really focused on debt repayment per se. They were just trying to figure out what their options are, what's going on. The ground was shifting way too fast. And so nobody really knew where we were going to settle out. And so that initial phase was really interesting. That was when, the markets crashed and everything else. So at that point, the most important thing that big companies needed to do is to treat it like a black swan event, which means be agile, be fast, and very, very quickly establish yourself as an independent advocate, empathetic advocate of consumers. You know, reach out to them early and often, give them assurances, stand by them. And, you know, the value that you build into that relationship with the consumer, you're going to be able to amortize over the next 10 to 20 years. Because in those moments of great chaos, standing by your customers will parlay into a very, very trusted, loyal relationship for a very long time. Then we entered this other phase, which was, COVID is COVID. And we are now living with it for a long time. And people were starting to build an understanding of how, like, life with COVID. Periodic shutdowns, reopenings, government subsidies, a slow and uneven, but nevertheless, a movement towards reopenings and return to normalcy, the introduction of vaccines. So all of those things over the last, 12 to 18 months. So in this other environment, what people learned, it's all been about digital transformation, moving towards more digital engagement with customers, understanding that traditional methods of communication aren't going to be as effective, understanding that you need to be more empathetic and you need to kind of have a different way of you're thinking about consumers in the long run. And so you're seeing these big companies all of a sudden make the long-term investment into big migrations to the cloud. And all of those big migrations have accelerated now, and big investments into things that are going to allow their businesses to be more scalable and agile and flexible. And so technologies like Cement obviously sit at the center of that, really. And so it gives you more agility, allows you to respond to new events faster, unexpected circumstances faster. And in good times or stable times or chaotic times, it just allows you to adjust much, much better. So that's the world that we're in now. And so it's more about, there's no big shift. It's about stops and starts, you know, three steps forward, one step back, then two more steps forward. Gradually and steady, she goes across the world. And so I think we're going to be living in this new world for a very, very long time. And in this new world, what we're seeing is that everybody's doing digital engagement. Everybody is migrating. Everybody's trying to use words like empathy and things like that. But, you know, truly being good at this stuff is about more than words. It's about making the large scale investments necessary to build a technology that these large organizations can use in an agile way. I think Cement has made those investments. I think that's why we're going to be one of the winners in this space. But it's going to be a long time until things go back to total normal. Like, COVID is going to be with us for a long time. Everybody's doing digital engagement now. So digital fatigue is becoming a thing. So instead of just being like, hey, we're digitally enabled, it's like, we have digital, and our digital is very targeted and smart, so we don't overwhelm customers and turn into like background noise, you know? And so that's what I think is going to be the next big shift, is like, how do we adjust to a more demanding customer that wants digital, but wants that digital in a very specific way, and their preferences are set to shift over time? And how do we, in an agile way, adapt to an environment where consumer shifts, preferences shift faster and faster?
Hanif, our last question. What was the best advice you've received in your career that you wanted to share?
That's a good question. I mean, so, you know, I live in Alberta. I think this is true everywhere, but in Alberta, I'd like to think it's especially true, because it's a very kind of like, you know, it's an enterprising, entrepreneurial place, but it's also very like prairie Canadian, Midwestern Canadian culture, right? So it's the combination. Calgary, I like to say, is like the marriage between Canadian little house on the prairies and capitalism, you know? And I love living in the intersection of those two things. Be trustworthy, operate with integrity. That's, I think, an incredibly important thing, for me personally, for Cement in general. Try to do the right thing, always, always, always. And, you know, and be really, really trustworthy, because that trust is, whether it's inside of your organization or dealing with customers or whoever else, it's an incredibly, you know, people trusting me to do the right thing is an incredibly important pillar of how I do business. And without it, I wouldn't be nearly as effective. Be empathetic to others. Would be the second one. And obviously, Cement being what it is, it's another underpinning of everything that we do. For me personally, the third one is, and this is something that I learned from my first mentor in the hedge fund days, outwork everyone. I live by that. Like, I mean, it's not necessarily the most popular thing these days, but I grew up with the mindset that you don't need to just be smart and have a great idea. You need to, if you want to be great at something, everybody else is trying to be great at it too. I always committed myself to outworking everyone. No one will ever outwork me. And that was the mindset I brought to business. And I think it's been a big part of my success. And then the final one is, make sure you're in a great relationship, like marry well. You know, entrepreneurship is not for everyone. And it doesn't just impact you, it impacts everyone around you. And so if you don't have the support system within your family to be an entrepreneur, it's 1,000 times harder to be successful. So I give a lot of the credit for my success to my mom, to my kids, to my wife, especially to my wife. You know, they stand by me through it all, and it's not easy on them. And as much as I make a lot of sacrifices, I chose this life, they didn't. And so they have to make those sacrifices too. So I owe a lot to them, and I try to repay them everywhere I can.
Wow, amazing. Well, I really appreciate you being in the podcast. It was truly inspiring to hearing from you, and I look forward to seeing where cement goes next.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.